From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Question from Canada? Prime Minister Jean Poutine said that he wouldn't endorse any candidate. He says that you look like the man who should lead the free world into the 21st century. Yeah, so what do you think about that? How's his endorsement?
Well, I appreciate his strong statement. He understands, I believe, in free trade.
What's wrong with this picture? Poutine is a Canadian dish of French fries and cheese, and Bush accepts the endorsement. Well, it's Super Tuesday. We'll look at the funny and the serious. We'll look at Proposition 22, a California anti-gay marriage ballot initiative, as well as funny money in the Bush campaign. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! For Democrats and Republicans alike, today is a defining day in the race for the White House. Super Tuesday is the busiest day yet of the primary season, with voting in almost every region of the nation. Republicans vote in 13 states with 613 delegates at stake. Voters in 15 states will award 1,315 Democratic delegates. Both parties will award more than half the delegates necessary to secure a nomination, while Republican John McCain and Democrat Bill Bradley are hoping for upset victories. Frontrunners Al Gore and George W. Bush hope decisive victories will gain them their respective parties' nomination. An unknown hacker vandalized the internet site for the Gallup organization just before today's presidential primary elections, but didn't change survey data from one of the nation's oldest polling companies. Gallup said none of its poll data was compromised because its vandalized website at www.gallup.com won't be connected to internal computers that store polling results until September 1st. That's when Gallup plans to make available through its website 65 years of data. Gallup results are relied upon heavily by campaigns and political journalists. In other internet news, the French Ministry of Finance has announced it's banned from official French civil service use many common English language business words such as startup and email. The goal, according to a detailed ministry statement issued yesterday, is to limit the spread of the English language throughout the internet. The ministry disclosed that government documents and civil servants have been directed to use the phrase a jeune pousse, or a young plant, for startup, and use the phrase courier électronique for email in all official government communications. The announcement comes as two French newspapers, Libération and Le Monde, noted last week that French President Chirac often used Anglo-computer terms. Last week, he referred to some companies as les start-up and to their managers as les start-upistes. This news from Chile. 3 days after General Augusto Pinochet returned home after his house arrest in Britain, a judge asked a Chilean court to strip the former dictator of his congressional immunity so he could stand trial. Yesterday's request by Judge Juan Guzman was a step toward putting Pinochet on trial for the killing and disappearance of 72 dissidents in the days following his 1973 coup. Guzman has already indicted several other military officers, including two generals, in the same case. The 22-member Santiago Court of Appeals would be the first to rule on Pinochet's immunity, after which either side can appeal to the Supreme Court. The process may take weeks, even months. Some have expressed concern that the military, which still strongly supports their former leader, may apply pressure to abort any trial. The commander of the U.S. military relief effort to flood-ravaged Mozambique denied today that the United States has been slow to respond to the catastrophe. The floodwaters that swept across the Southeast African nation 1 month ago and surged again 2 weeks ago have receded, leaving at least 400 confirmed dead and 1 million people either homeless or in desperate need of help. Aid agency officials expect the death toll to rise into the thousands. Scores of international relief organizations and at least 16 Western and African governments have provided an estimated $103 million in aid, but questions persist about the delay of the international response. The Tennessee Supreme Court ruled 4-1 yesterday that a condemned child murderer and rapist is mentally competent for execution, which would be Tennessee's first since 1960. Robert Glenn Coe is scheduled to die March 23rd. Last week, Coe's attorneys argued before the Supreme Court the state's process for determining mental competency is flawed and that Coe was denied his constitutional rights during a January competency hearing. The justices ruled Ko got a fair hearing and that he has the mental capacity to understand his impending execution and reason for it. Three white officers wept and cursed after a racially mixed jury found them guilty of trying to cover up the sodomy torture of a Haitian immigrant in a police precinct bathroom in Brooklyn, New York. Ex-patrolman Charles Schwarz and officers Thomas Weiss and Thomas Bruder were convicted yesterday of trying to conceal Schwarz's role in the 1997 attack on Abner Louima. A jury had found Schwarz guilty last year of holding down the handcuffed Louima while another officer, Justin Volpe, sodomized him with a broken broomstick. Meanwhile, federal prosecutors will put two more New York police officers on trial for allegedly lying about the torture of Louima. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the 35th anniversary of the Alabama State Trooper and Sheriff Deputy attack on more than 600 black protesters who marched over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama on March 7, 1965. In a little while, we'll talk more about that. But first, this.
This state are going to the polls today. And I like our chances.
Excuse me, Secretary. Question from Canada, from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Right.
Prime Minister Jean Poutine said that he wouldn't endorse any candidate in this race. The Prime Minister of Canada, Jean Poutine, said that he would not endorse any candidate in this race. And today he said that he believed that George W. Bush should be the man to lead the free world into the 21st century. How important is this endorsement?
I think he's a very smart man to make that endorsement, because he's exactly right.
Governor Engler, question from Canada. Question from Canada. Prime Minister Jean Poutine said that he wouldn't endorse any candidate in this election. Now he said that he believes George W. Bush is the man to lead the free world into the 21st century. Is this an important endorsement?
I certainly think he's got very good judgment in making that kind of a statement about George W. Bush.
Do you believe Mr. Bush would be happy to hear about Mr. Poutine's endorsement?
I think he'll be very, very ecstatic to hear that. I know he thinks very highly of him and regards him very highly. So
thank you very much.
Very happy to hear that.
Governor Bush, a question from Canada? Question from Canada?
All right, what about it?
Prime Minister Jean Poutine said that he wouldn't endorse any candidate. He says that you look like the man who should lead the free world into the 21st century. Yeah, so what do you think about that? How's his endorsement?
Well, I appreciate his strong statement. He understands I believe in free trade. He understands I want to make sure our relations with our most important neighbor to the north of us, the Canadians, is strong, and we'll work closely together.
Well, it seems that George W. Bush has gotten into trouble again over the name of a world leader. After a rally in Canton, Michigan 2 weeks ago, a man posing as a Canadian television reporter told Bush that Canadian Prime Minister Jean Poutine had endorsed him for his presidential bid. Bush beamed. But unfortunately for Bush, Canada's prime minister is Jean Chrétien, not Poutine. Poutine is a popular French-Canadian concoction of French fries and cheese curds smothered in gravy. The man posing as the journalist was Canadian comedian Rick Mercer. He hosts a program on CBC Network called This Hour Has 22 Minutes. The show often lampoons American ignorance of Canadian culture and politics. Last season, he had the governor of Arkansas convinced that Canada was building an igloo to protect its parliament building. And Rick Mercer joins us now from Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
So any fallout from the French fry endorsement of George W. Bush?
Well, the Prime Minister's office here released a statement a couple of days ago saying that clearly Canada was not in the Bush leagues. Our Prime Minister does have a sense of humor, luckily.
So tell us about that scene 2 weeks ago.
Well, with 22 minutes, our show is a political satire show, so we like to go out to various political events. We never know what we're going to get. Generally, they just create a backdrop for us, and I always wanted to go to a primary. I'm a bit of a political junkie, so and of course, your primary system baffles me entirely. I did read Primaries for Idiots, and I still can't really figure it out. But I really wanted to go to one and, hear the man speak. And I was lucky enough to get close enough to fire off a question to Governor Bush, Governor Engler, and the Secretary of State there.
So that was Governor Engler we first heard, the governor of Michigan?
Yeah.
And the campaign chief.
The first one was actually Candace Miller, who's a Secretary of State and state historian for Michigan.
Which borders
Canada? I thought
for
sure she would know. I mean, she lives in a border state. They do about $56 million worth of trade a day between Michigan and Canada. So I thought perhaps the Secretary of State and official state historian might have some inkling who the Prime Minister of Canada was, but no chance.
Tell us about the igloo.
I'm sorry?
Tell us about the igloo.
Well, that was sometimes I do a piece, I just wander around, I talk to, the average man on the street type interviews, and I just tell them things about Canada, we're now experiencing 9 months of darkness or what have you, and I happen to be in Arkansas, and I wanted to go to Arkansas, your president, being from there, and I was just wandering around telling people that we were doing a story because their state capitol buildings are miniatures of the buildings in Washington, and ours are actually miniatures of the Arkansas state capitol buildings, the National Parliament buildings of Canada, except, of course, ours is an igloo, and it's melting because of global warming, so we're trying to build a big dome over it to protect it from the hole in the ozone. And what did people think about that? And I was interviewing people on the street, and, of course, people thought this was, entirely possible, of course, being in Canada, that we would have a national igloo. And then we saw the governor go into the state capitol building, so we wandered in and followed him in and told him that the people of Canada would be so honored if he would just say a few words about our national igloo and preventing it from melting. So he said, he asked me, he pulled me aside and said, is this national igloo controversial at all? I said, no, sir, it's not controversial. He said, I'll do it. And he looked into the camera and said, hello, Canada, I'm Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas, congratulating you on preserving your national igloo, and then gave us a big thumbs up.
You sound a little, Rick Mercer, like Michael Moore here in the United States.
Well, we just like to go around and get up to no good, basically. I mean, we do it all the time in Canada. I don't travel to the States that often and do it. But we have been on the air for 7 years. And, of course, generally we've been going to our own capital, Ottawa, and we've been kind of goofing around there for so long that we just had to broaden our horizons a little bit. And so that's just one of the things we like to do. And we like to get up to no good, and say the bad thing. In Canada, we live next to the United States, and we're inundated with American culture and American television, and so we just know so much about America. Now, when we stop and think about it, we hardly expect Americans to know as much about Canada as we do about you, because, of course, we're not beaming, 1,700 channels down there every day, and we just don't have the size. But of course, Canadians always get a kick out of traveling in the States and having Americans say things like, so do you have any sunlight up there these days? Or I guess you go to school on skidoos, is it?
How does your system work in terms of voting for a prime minister?
Well, of course, we don't have primaries. Like I say, that's where my ignorance kicks in. I can't figure out the primaries, at all. But we don't have primaries. Obviously, we're a democracy. We have no term limits. We have a prime minister of Canada. We're also kind of a monarchy up here, so it's a bit wonky that way.
And you also don't have term limits?
We don't have term limits. That's something that's kind of exciting or interesting that we've been following lately, because it's not that term limits are an issue. They're not an issue up here at all. We just don't have them. And the Prime Minister of Canada has always indicated he's going to leave after his second term, and generally that's what most prime ministers do. But now he's planning on sticking around for a third term because he's wildly popular, and, of course, the economy is just chugging along like it is in the States. And so there's lots of money and stuff, so why would he leave? And, of course, this is causing some consternation among his cabinet, because a number of these guys and girls have been lining themselves up to replace him, and so now we're starting to watch an unofficial leadership campaign and lots of backstabbing going on. And so
speaking of money, I understand your government is missing a lot of it lately, about, what, $1 million?
Yeah. There was like a couple of billion dollars went missing there a little while ago, and in something called the Department of Human Rights Human Resources and Development, and that's just one of those gigantic departments that gives away grants to you know, everything. That's where the employment grants come from. That's where, like, you know, anything, you know, that's where, you know, job creation grants come from, all sorts of different grants. So I guess it's mainly the accounting procedures are so abysmal that no one knows where it is. And so that's been, you know, that's been an ongoing story up here for, you know, a number of months now with people screaming for Jane Stewart's head, who happens to be the minister. But, you know, she's handling it well, I think.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Rick Mercer. Maybe she could find some comfort in that French-Canadian dish made of French fries and cheese curds.
I'm sure she will. It's a heart attack on a plate. You should all try it.
It's called poutine.
Prime Minister Jean Poutine said that he wouldn't endorse any candidate. He says that you look like the man who should lead the free world into the 21st century. Yeah, so what do you think about that? How's his endorsement?
Well, I appreciate his strong statement. He understands, I believe, in free trade. He understands I want to make sure our relations with our most important neighbor to the north of us, the Canadians, is strong. And we'll work closely together.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we head south. We're going to California. Yesterday is Super Tuesday, and voters in California are deciding on a number of ballot measures, 20 in all. One of these is Proposition 22, the California Protection of Marriage Initiative. It states that only a marriage between a man and a woman is valid and recognized in California. California now allows only non-gay couples to marry, but it does validate marriages that are legal in the state where they were performed. Prop 22 would prohibit the state from recognizing these out-of-state same-sex marriages. We're joined now by Jenny Pizer, who's managing attorney for the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us about what are the chances for Prop 22 in California, this anti-gay marriage ballot measure?
Well, it's really hard to call. There's been a lot of media coverage and lots of ads on both sides of the issues, and a lot of people talking about this measure. It's been one of the most hotly debated ones during this election season, so it's going to depend how many people get out and vote today.
So the measure was sponsored by Republican State Senator Pete Knight, whose gay son is among the proposition's opponents.
Yes, Pete Knight has had some sort of personal obsession with gay people and whether we can marry for years now. He started on this crusade to try to prevent gay and lesbian people from being able to marry or have marriages recognized in California back 4 years ago with a couple measures. He's had three measures that he brought forward in the state legislature, and when he didn't make any progress there, he's taken it to the voters.
Tell us about exactly what this bill means. I mean, if it were passed, it says that if gay marriage is accepted in other states, it would be accepted in California. But at this point, it is not accepted. Is that right? Except perhaps Vermont?
Well, at this point, no states allow gay and lesbian couples to marry. And so this is really, that underscores why this is such a pointless and a divisive measure here in California. Pete Knight says that there's some sort of, he sees some sort of threat to quote, traditional marriage here in California. And what we hope people will see is that this is just one more in a history of quite divisive measures, ballot measures here in California, that pick on a particular group of people and ask the majority to take a vote on a measure when, in fact, the marriage law in California is what it is, and this measure won't change anything one way or the other. Our big concern, really, is that if it is passed, it may be used in the future here in California as a legal tool for denying gay and lesbian people other sorts of legal rights. We've seen this sort of so-called protection of marriage type measure used like that in other states.
Where is the money coming from in fueling the ads? Yesterday, looking at the juvenile justice bill, Prop 21, I think it was, we saw Chevron and Pacific Gas and Electric pouring money in to this bill. What about the anti-gay marriage statute, Prop 22?
Well, a lot of the money has come from ultra-conservative folks like Howard Amundson, who has had an anti-gay agenda himself for a very long time. He's actually known for having advocated that gay people should have been put to death. Of course, Many of the funders aren't quite that extreme, but the Mormon Church has put an enormous amount of money in, and the Catholic Church has too, and some other very, very conservative religious organizations. So this is not a measure that has had institutional support, I'm pleased to say. And in fact, there's been an enormous outpouring of voices against it from lots of elected officials, most of the leading Democratic leaders, everyone from President Clinton and presidential candidates Gore and Bradley, Senators Feinstein and Boxer, a number of leading Republicans, and also many of the, in fact, most
McCain
of
McCain has come out for it, is that right? And Bush hasn't taken a stand?
Actually, Bush and McCain both have come out for it, which wasn't really a surprise. But most of the leading newspapers in the state also have come out against it. So it's really a question of whether people understand that it may have a lot of consequences other than whatever the marriage law is, because the marriage law isn't going to be changed either way in terms of whether people can marry in California or can marry in any other state anytime immediately soon.
Hmm. Jenny Pizer, thanks for being with us, managing attorney for the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, speaking to us from Los Angeles. The proposition is Proposition 22. It's called the California Protection of Marriage Initiative, and it would rule out gay marriages that are performed in other states from being recognized in California. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. 35 years ago today, on March 7, 1965, Alabama state troopers attacked 600 black men, women, and children as they marched for their right to vote. The sheriff's deputies and state troopers used nightsticks and tear gas on the marchers, led by the Reverend Martin Luther King, as they tried to make their way from Selma to Montgomery. Televised images of the brutality shocked the nation and helped spur the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Thousands gathered on Sunday with President Clinton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson to commemorate the march. Well, last year, Democracy Now! Technical Director Errol Maitland went down to Selma, and he spoke with Joanne Bland, resident historian of the Voting Rights Museum, as they sat in the museum at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which has become an icon of the civil rights movement. And Joanne Bland remembered that day, March 7th, 1965.
We left Brown Chapel AME Church, going to the bridge, coming to the bridge, thinking that we were doing a symbolic march. It wasn't supposed to go to Montgomery in the first place, that they knew that it wouldn't. It was supposed to be a symbolic thing that we go and then we turn around and come back, but it didn't happen that way. When we got to the bridge, I was in the middle of the bridge when all of a sudden they started to kneel and pray, but the men in the group came and crowded, put all the women in the middle. That was my first inkling that something was wrong, that something bad was going to happen, because that had never happened before, and I had been on hundreds of marches. And by the time we all kneeled down, I heard what I thought were gunshots and screams. So I thought they were killing the people up front. They were just shooting them. And by the time we got up enough to see what was happening, it was like the domino effect. The people from the front were running back, and people on horses, and were rioting and beating people. Horses were stepping on people, even coming back. The troopers had on a gas mask. But at that time, I didn't know what a gas mask was. So there were these monsters in uniform running toward us, beating people unmercifully. The last thing I remember on the bridge was a horse. This man had come over the hill, and he was just beating people, just hitting anybody. And the horse bumped this lady, and she fell down. And the horse reared up, and when it came down, his hoof came down on her arm, and it broke it, and the bone came through here, and blood just went up like a fountain. It's the last thing I remember until I woke up on this side of the bridge in the back of a car. And my sister, Mrs. Jefferson, and her husband were the people who were attending me. And when I awakened, Mrs. Jefferson found my sister somehow in the crowd and brought her to me, and she was covered with blood. Her shirt, her whole face was in stripes. It was just horrible. And she eventually had 37 stitches in the back of her head where she had been hit. You could see her getting hit in Eyes on the Prize. It's quite vivid. She's a little girl with a white coat on, and they're beating her, and she's trying to get away. But we went back to the church. We got to the church, they ran us out of the church. The same thing happened at the church, except we didn't have tear gas at the church. They just came in and started beating people. And I felt a hopelessness then, because I felt like nothing was sacred, nothing was safe. We were not safe anymore, because they came into our churches and did this. They came into the church and did this. Nobody could save us, even God. You know, we were just done and doomed.
Have you seen in your lifetime tangible changes that have happened, that have occurred, that are positive, that came about as a result of your trying to march across that bridge, if you're being arrested over and over and thrown in jail from the age of 11 years old?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I think it's important, especially to our children, that they know that we've made gains, that all these struggles have not been in vain. For one thing, now I live in a neighborhood I could never have walked in. People own houses in neighborhoods they could never go in. Our children go to school together, and some of our schools are half and half. Those are our better schools. The predominantly black schools are just terrible. They lack in money. Okay, I've seen my councilman, the faces change. I've seen a black female on the panel. I've seen things happen in our community that would never ever happen. We own businesses now that
Do we own more businesses now than we did back in 1969?
Oh, big time, especially here in Selma. Our main street is Broad Street. You would never have seen a black business on Broad Street in 65. Nothing was there but whites, period. You were not even allowed to. If you could even think about buying, it never crossed your mind to think about buying a business on building on Broad Street.
Joanne Bland is the resident historian at the Voting Rights Museum at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, a symbol of the civil rights struggle, where 35 years ago today, more than 600 marchers for equality and voting rights, black men, women, and children, were beaten by Alabama state troopers and sheriff's deputies. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. John McCain's presidential campaign yesterday filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission about a TV ad being run by Republicans for Clean Air, a name being used by Texas software billionaires Sam and Charles Wiley. The McCain campaign also urged the Federal Communications Commission to take action, saying the ad should not be run until a disclaimer is attached identifying the Wileys as the sponsors. The two brothers did not take responsibility for the ads for several days until exposed in the New York Times. The Wileys have run these $2 million in TV ads that don't urge a vote for either candidate, but they bash McCain for his record on solar and renewable energy programs and characterize Bush as an environmental crusader. One of them, Sam Wiley, owns an energy company called Green Mountain. The Wiley brothers have donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to Bush for his gubernatorial and presidential campaign. There are other Bush connections to the ads. The woman who bought the time for the ads also works for a political action committee led by a longtime Bush supporter, and the ads were placed by Multimedia, which has done work for Bush supporters. The ads have run in San Francisco, Columbus, Ohio, across New York State, and Burlington, Vermont. But some stations were jittery about running them, given questions about whether the group, which did not exist a week ago, is legitimate. With Bush and McCain both now fighting over their environmental credentials, we're going to look at their environmental records in Texas and Arizona. We're joined by Ken Kramer, who is the Texas State Director of the Sierra Club. He speaks to us from Austin. And Robin Silver, who is co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona, and a former Republican congressional candidate. We both welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Ken Kramer and the Bush environmental record.
Thanks, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Yes, it's very interesting to see these ads in several other states that are touting Bush's environmental record, considering that the actual fact is that Bush has had a very poor environmental record, and some of the things that he's taking credit for are things that are requirements, stem back to requirements of federal legislation, as well as the acts of his predecessor as governor of Texas, Ann Richards. In the ad, for example, that's been running in New York and Ohio and California and perhaps other states as well, by a group called Republicans for Clean Air, which is apparently a new group, a few Republicans who've just gotten religion on the environment within the last week. They tout Governor Bush's record on the environment, especially with regard to air pollution, and tout his efforts in the legislature last year to supposedly bring grandfathered power plants, dirty old industrial power plants, into our permitting process and reduce emissions. As a matter of fact, Bush has pushed a voluntary program for those plants at best, a very ineffective voluntary program. Last session in the legislature, he essentially had to swallow a mandatory into the grandfathering for the power plants as a result of pressure from Democratic legislators on the House State Affairs Committee who wouldn't let his electric deregulation bill out of the committee without several provisions, including the end to the grandfathering of power plants. And so now, much in the way that our Senator Phil Graham often takes credit for federal largesse that he opposes, Governor Bush is trying to take credit for something which he opposed at the outset only had to take because he wanted an electric deregulation bill so badly.
I was watching Mary Madeline, who was Bush Jr.'s father's assistant or aide, who is the big commentator on television, saying that George Bush Jr. has gotten rid of more toxins in Texas than all 49 states combined.
Well, the reality is that if you look at the figures, what they're saying is that from 1995, I believe, to 1997, that Texas manufacturing facilities reduced their toxic releases and discharges by 43 million pounds, which is more than the rest of the country combined. Well, if you look at the actual figures, that is correct, but there is those figures are somewhat misleading. For one thing, obviously Texas has a much bigger petrochemical refining complex than practically, I guess, any other state in the country. And we produce more toxics, especially in terms of air emissions, than any other state. So obviously we have a capacity to reduce much greater than the rest of the country. And the reductions that did occur were the result primarily of two factors. One was the 1990 Federal Clean Air Act amendments, which put in new requirements for reducing toxic emissions from a number of industries, which have kicked in the mid and late 1990s. And a second factor was a toxics reduction program that was initiated and implemented by Governor Ann Richards. Essentially, of course, Bush only took office in January of 95. Nothing in the way of his policies had any impact on reductions from 95 to 97. There just simply wouldn't have been time, even if he had taken the ball and run with it. So he's now trying to take credit for something that the federal government has required and something that his predecessor, Ann Richards, really initiated.
I'm looking at the response ad that McCain has released in New York, where he touts his own environmental record and says, "The Sierra Club said it best. Praising George Bush on clean air is like thanking John Rocker for his contribution to civil rights."
Right. Definitely true. Yes, Governor Bush has a very poor environmental record, and we've tried to make that clear to people around the country. In part, frankly, because we want more visibility to the problems in Texas, and hopefully that will bring some pressure on our politicians in our own state to clean up our pollution problems. But we definitely want to make it clear to everybody around the country that George Bush is not deserving of the vote of environmentalists based upon his record. His record speaks for itself, and it's a very poor record.
Well, let's talk about John McCain, his opponent. Robin Silver, you're a Republican. You ran for Congress from Arizona. You're also co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, though we're speaking to you in Eugene, Oregon, where you're attending the National Environmental Law Conference. What is McCain's environmental record?
Well, good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
It's hard for me, before we go to John McCain's record, it's hard for me to not listen, just as an avid news fan. I listen to the problems in Texas, because if I remember correctly, Houston is still, or Houston surpassed Los Angeles now as the worst, or having the worst air in the country. I think that's still the capital of the petrochemical industry. So for them to claim they've reduced air emissions or reduced toxins is really hypocritical. If you're looking also at Mary Madeline or his father's advisors, you look at George W.'s advisors now. I mean, George W.'s advisors are advocating selling off national parks to the highest bidders.
Who specifically?
Talking about John McCain, or I'm here to talk about John McCain, whose environmental voting record is atrocious. But you know, before we go on, we just have to acknowledge that there's no way that you can paint George W.'s record as anything but even worse than John McCain's record.
Well, what about John McCain, who you've dealt with for years?
Well, if you look at his votes, which is all that really matter for politicians, is that in 1999, if you look at his votes, and the League of Conservation Voters rates our congressional people, John McCain had a record of 11%. If you look at his record of 16 years in Congress, he's less than 20% on votes that are friendly to environmental issues. John McCain is particularly notorious for his congressional riders that evade environmental oversights, harm endangered species, and are outright hostile towards endangered species protection, which is what we worked to protect.
Can you talk about some of the major controversies that McCain has been involved with?
Well, I think his biggest controversies have been the congressional riders that he sponsors, and the riders are a legislation that they're stealth. They come in the middle of the night, or they come without public review. They always come by surprise, and they prevent our ability to use the laws that we have to protect endangered species. He has sponsored two congressional riders for a telescope project in Arizona that foreclose our ability to protect endangered species in the area. When the endangered species moratorium came about a few years ago, John McCain voted for that. We have a very endangered antelope on the border that John McCain has promoted with another rider, low-level flights in the area of their endangered Sonoran pronghorn. It's been very frustrating, as you can hear, when you're trying to protect any endangered species. He literally hamstrings the Fish and Wildlife Service when they're trying to protect species, and then when the Forest Service is trying to fund their Fish and Wildlife Service protection programs, you know, once again, he worked against funding for those programs. So, you know, once again, if you look at or you listen to his rhetoric, he's starting to sound pretty green, as what usually happens when folks start trying to present themselves in a favorable light. But if you look at his overall record, I mean, it's not even close to passing. He would get an F, a failing mark by any standards on his environmental record over the last 16 years.
We are talking to Robin Silver, co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona, former Republican congressional candidate himself, Ken Kramer, who is Texas State Director of the Sierra Club. When we come back, we're going to be joined by two people from Texas, including the producer of the ads that have been so controversial that the George W. Bush campaign has been accused of being affiliated with. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we finish up in this very cursory look at the environmental records of George Bush and John McCain. Robin Silver, you were just going through the record of John McCain. Robin Silver, co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Mount Graham being a major issue in Arizona.
Well, you know, as a person moves from their position locally as a senator or governor, then they always try to present themselves in a different light. In the case of John McCain, if you look at Mount Graham as an issue.
And explain what Mount Graham is.
Mount Graham is an area that is sacred to traditional Apache people, and it's an area where there's an endangered animal there, the Mount Graham red squirrel. And this is an area where, as I mentioned before, where John McCain was. We notoriously call him one of the Mount Graham Three in reference to the Keating Five and the SNL scandals. And the reason is, similarly, is that as federal officials have tried to protect some of our endangered species here, then John McCain comes in and aggressively threatens federal officials. And in this particular case, there's even a documented transcript of one of his sessions where he told the forest supervisor who was trying to protect species at that time that if he did not cooperate on the project, he would be the shortest tenured forest supervisor in the history of the Forest Service. Now, you know, what that forest supervisor was trying to do was obey laws.
Was that illegal to threaten him like that?
It's not only is it illegal.
Why is it illegal?
Well, it's illegal to obstruct the ability of any federal official to do their job. In the bigger picture, however, though, you know, this is a consistent type of a behavior. We saw it in the SNL scandal, and now we've seen it when folks attempt to protect endangered species. And, you know, what it says is on one hand, it might be a good quality to be an advocate for something that you believe in. But on the other hand, it just shows how far that you will go for advocacy if you're representing people that own you. And, you know, while we're talking about campaign finance reform, you know, we can't forget that for 16 years we're talking about a senator who has represented the people that own him
very well, and that's why he has such a dismal environmental record. Less than 20% over 16 years, 11% in 1999. You can't escape that fact.
11%.
11% in 1999.
11% voting record on environmental issues?
Yes. In the case of Mount Graham particularly, you'll notice that the senator talks about what he's done for Indian people. Remember, this is an area that is sacred to traditional Apache people. The traditional elders went in person and begged Senator McCain to please don't put this project in an area that impedes their ability to practice their religion. He turned his back.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us, Robin Silver of the Center for Biological Diversity. Your website?
I'm sorry. The website is www.southwestcenter.org.
That's www.southwestcenter.org. I thank you for being with us. And now we're going to play the controversial ad that is being run by Republicans for Clean Air, a name being used by the Texas billionaires and top Bush supporters Sam and Charles Wiley, that attacks Senator John McCain's record.
Last year, John McCain voted against solar and renewable energy. That means more use of coal-burning plants that pollute our air. New York Republicans care about clean air. So does Governor Bush. He led one of the first states in America to clamp down on old coal-burning electric power plants. Bush clean air laws will reduce air pollution more than 250,000 tons a year. That's like taking 5 million cars off the road. Governor Bush, leading, so each day dawns brighter.
One of the ads that was run against John McCain. We're joined right now by Rob Allen, who's a producer of the ads, and also Andrew Wheat from Texans for Public Justice, speaking to us from Austin, Texas. Rob Allen, can you talk about this controversy behind the ads and the group that was hastily put together, Republicans for Clean Air, that in fact are the Texas billionaires Sam and Charles Wiley, well-known Bush supporters?
Well, and Sam is also a very well-known environmentalist. He has about $100 million investment in GreenMountain.com, which is a Vermont-based company, which is the nation's leading provider of clean energy from solar and wind, water, et cetera. And Sam's issue, I mean, the issue that gets Sam out of bed in the morning is clean air. His Sterling software company to devote the rest of his life to promotion of clean energy and clean air, and specifically solar and renewable power, which Senator McCain voted against, and George Bush led Texas to place mandates on the electric utility industry, which is the number one polluter of our air with these old grandfathered coal-burning power plants.
Hmm. Andrew Weed of Texans for Public Justice, your comment on their record and their involvement in the ad campaign?
Well, I think I would have to agree more with Ken Kramer, who was on earlier, that this ad that we're talking about and just heard is a gross distortion of Governor Bush's environmental record. As Ken Kramer said, the ad says that Bush led on this issue. The truth is that Bush followed. And environmental groups down here in Texas did an open records request on Bush's voluntary program to clean up the air. The fact is that our state Clean Air Act had a loophole in it for old power plants and old industrial facilities. And that loophole has been in existence for 30 years. Bush went to representatives of Exxon and Mobil and asked them what he should do about this problem, and they suggested that he put together a voluntary program. Well, these same companies have had 30 years to volunteer to clean up the air and didn't do it. They missed their chance. So certain environmentalists in the state, certain members of the legislature said, well, it's finally time, 30 years down the line, to clean this up. Bush was forced to sign that bill to get something else that his big donors wanted, which was the deregulation of our local electricity markets. And so you can't really say he led on this issue. He followed.
Well, I mean, I think we can debate semantics about lead or follow. The fact is that Governor Bush, as we say in the ad, signed new clean air laws here in Texas, Senate Bill 7, which is the electric restructuring that and deregulation that the other guest mentioned. And that bill ultimately is going to take 250,000 tons of air pollution out of the air, which, as the ad points out, is equivalent to taking 5.5 million cars off our roads here in Texas. Made Texas one of the first three states in the nation to clamp down on these old coal-burning power plants. Now, I agree with your other guests that the restrictions on refineries and cotton gins and bakeries were voluntary and industry-driven. But the worst polluter of our air in this country is the electric utility industry, specifically with these grandfathered coal-burning power plants, which are really the nemesis of every good environmentalist. And Governor Bush did sign laws to compel them to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions by 50% by the year 23 and sulfur dioxide by 25%. And that's leadership in the right direction. It may not be everything that every environmentalist wants, but it certainly is vastly superior to Senator McCain's abysmal record of voting against solar and renewable energy when he had the opportunity in Congress.
Let me ask you, Rob Allen, producer of the ads, because the Wileys aren't speaking about them right now, about using this device of setting up a group, Republicans for Clean Air, and then putting out $2 million for these television ads. There's a cap of $1,000 that you can give to a candidate. And so instead, directly giving this money, which has led McCain to file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission.
Well, look, the only thing dirty going on here is the pollution that's spewing out of the smokestacks of the coal-burning power plants that John McCain voted to protect by voting against solar and renewable power. The Wileys are a family that have consistently been willing to put their money where their mouth is. They've made more than $100 million investment in GreenMountain.com, the nation's leading provider of clean energy, and they have a right to free speech. And, you know, yes, we do have a $1,000 cap on direct contributions to the campaign. The Wileys have abided by that. And we have not coordinated these expenses in any way with the Bush campaign. This was an independent act by an environmentalist entrepreneur who believes in what he says, and he has the opportunity. And the truth is, would you and I be talking about this today? Would I have been on the phone all day yesterday with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times? Would we be on ABC World News tonight if we had passed out leaflets about this a year from now? No, we're on it because they spent $2 million during a hotly contested presidential primary.
Well,
that's why we're talking about clean air this
week.
Well,
McCain contends that Sam Wiley, who's an authorized fundraiser for the Bush campaign, he's one of the Bush pioneers pledged to raise $100,000, is therefore not eligible to finance a so-called independent issue ad.
Actually, technically, Sam is not a pioneer. His brother Charles is one of the pioneers. But in any case, those folks are volunteers, as you well know. They aren't campaign staffers. They're not paid by the campaign, and they're not official agents of the campaign. But in any case, the first question they asked when they hired our firm last Friday, I got a call out of the clear blue sky asking if we could create these ads for them. And the first question they asked was, have you done any work for the Bush presidential campaign? The answer was no. And it was only on that basis, following the law very strictly to the letter, that we could proceed on the project.
Andrew Wheat from Texans for Public Justice. The company that Rob Allen is talking about, Green Mountain, Sam Wiley's company, saying it's one of the cleanest energy companies in the country.
Mm-hmm. Here's the story. The first thing is, I don't think the only thing that's dirty around the United States right now is the air. The political system is dirty, and the fact that the Wileys can spend $2.5 million to get their message out when ordinary Americans can't is a serious problem, and I don't equate money with speech. It's not the same thing. The problems with our campaign finance system are at the root of the problems with our environment. People like John McCain, people like George Bush, people like Al Gore, who can be bought and paid for by special interests, have an interest in doing certain things that the rest of us aren't doing, and often that results in destruction of the environment. Coming back to Green Mountain, the founding company of Green Mountain initially was Green Mountain Power Up in Vermont, which has a big stake in the Vermont nuclear facility. the Vermont Yankee nuclear facility. It also has been associated with the other major source of its power is the Quebec, the dams up in Quebec that have flooded immense amounts of Cree native lands in Quebec. The Wileys acquired this company, and they have a special niche that they're seeking under a deregulated power market. Last year, Governor Bush signed a deregulation bill for the state of Texas. Other states had already done so, including California. Public Citizen criticized a sale that GreenMountain.com, the Wiley company, was doing back in 1998 in California, where they were selling clean hydropower to environmentally conscious Californians. And here's the kind of semantics and complexities that you can't really get into in a 30-second ad. But Public Citizen's complaint was, yes, they were selling hydropower from Oregon to Californians, but that created a deficit in power back in Oregon, which the company that provided it, PacifiCorp, had to make up with by jacking up its coal power plants, the very kinds of coal power plants that are criticized in this Wiley ad.
I want to go back to a second to the point of equating money with free speech and point out that the Sierra Club has spent a good bit of money running ads attacking Governor Bush on environmental issues. And I just am failing to grasp the principle that the Sierra Club is allowed to have free speech. The unions are allowed to spend about $46 million a year in this country on political advertising, which, by the way, is taken out of workers' paychecks without their permission. But the Wileys don't have an opportunity to spread their views about their free enterprise version of environmentalism. And I would put it to you that the Sierra Club no more has a monopoly on environmental solutions or gospel about environmentalism in general, then coal-burning power plants should have a monopoly over their generation of electricity.
Giving the last word to Andrew Wheat from Texans for Public Justice.
Well, that's a false argument. Obviously, the Sierra Club and the unions, nobody said that they should be the only ones to have the right to speech. What we're talking about is changing the campaign finance laws in this country so that none of these special interests are able to buy out our politicians, which has a destructive effect on the environment as well as a vast array of issues that we all care about. It's a dirty system, and it's not just the air that's dirty. It's the political system. It needs to be changed.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for joining us. Rob Allen, producer of the controversial ads by the Wiley brothers, Sam and Charles Wiley, who put together a group in the last week called Republicans for Clean Air, and the ads attacking the environmental record of John McCain. Now, John McCain filing a complaint with the Federal Election Commission about the TV ads and also urging the Federal Communications Commission to take action, saying the ads should not be run until a disclaimer is attached identifying the Wileys as the sponsors. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow, a special on International Women's Day. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director, and special thanks to Turtle. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.